studying mouse retroviruses, and, frustrated, switched from the lab to clinical oncology at San Francisco General Hospital. For Wohlberding, and for many of his earliest patients, AIDS was cancer. To treat his sarcoma patients, Wohlberding borrowed various chemotherapy regimens from the NCI's protocols. The notion of using a cocktail of drugs against HIV was borrowed from oncology, although it would be several years before anti-HIV drugs were available. But more than chemotherapy protocols, Wohlberding borrowed something more ineffable, an ethos. At San Francisco General, at the end of a long linoleum-floored corridor with chipped paint on the walls and naked light bulbs dangling from wires, Wohlberding and his team created the world's first AIDS ward, called Ward 5A, which was explicitly modeled after the cancer wards that he had seen as a fellow. "What we did here," he recalls, "was exactly like an oncology unit, but with a different focus, AIDS. But it really was modeled on oncology units, where you have complex medical diseases with a lot of psychosocial overlay, a lot of use of drugs that are complex and require a sophisticated nursing staff and psychosocial support staff. Nurses, many of them gay men, gravitated to Ward 5A to tend their friends, or returned poignantly, as the epidemic bloomed, as patients themselves. Doctors reinvented medicine here, pitting their wits against a hostile, mysterious disease that they couldn't quite fathom, that was plaguing a community that they didn't quite understand. As the patients boiled up with bizarre, spectral fevers, rules were unshackled and reinvented, creating a ward that came to resemble the unorthodox lives of the men who inhabited it. Fixed visiting hours were eliminated. Friends, companions, lovers, and family members were allowed, even encouraged, to sleep overnight in accompanying cots to help patients through those burning, hallucinatory nights. On Sunday afternoons, a San Francisco dancer catered elaborate brunches featuring tap dancing, feather boas, and marijuana-laced brownies. Farber may not have envisioned these particular innovations, but this, too, in a community drenched with grief, was its own inimitable interpretation of total care. Politically, too, AIDS activists borrowed language and tactics from cancer lobbyists, and then imbued this language with their own urgency and potency. In January 1982, as AIDS cases boomed, a group of six men founded Gay Men's Health Crisis in New York, a volunteer organization dedicated to fighting AIDS through advocacy, lobbying, campaigning, and protest. Early volunteers decamped outside discos, bars, and bathhouses, soliciting donations and distributing posters. From its office in a crumbling Chelsea brownstone, GMHC coordinated an extraordinary national effort to bring AIDS awareness to the masses. These were the Lascarites of AIDS, albeit without the gray suits and pearls. The seminal scientific breakthrough in the AIDS epidemic was, meanwhile, unfolding in a laboratory at the Institut Pasteur in Paris. In January 1983, Luc Montagnier's group found the sign of a virus in a lymph node biopsy from a young gay man with Kaposi sarcoma and in a Zairean woman who had died of immune deficiency. Montagnier soon deduced that this was an RNA virus that could convert its genes into DNA and lodge into the human genome, a retrovirus. He called his virus IDAV, immunodeficiency-associated viruses, arguing that it was likely the cause of AIDS. At the National Cancer Institute, a group led by Robert Gallo was also circling around the same virus, although under a different name. In the spring of 1984, the two efforts converged dramatically. Gallo also found a retrovirus in AIDS patients, Montagnier's IDAV. A few months later, the identity of the virus was confirmed by yet another group in San Francisco. On April 23, 1984, Margaret Heckler, the Health and Human Services Secretary, thus appeared before the press with a bold statement about the future of the epidemic. With a causal agent in hand, a cure seemed just a few steps away. The arrow of funds, medical personnel, research has hit the target, she said. We hope to have a vaccine ready for testing in about 2 years. Today's discovery represents the triumph of science over dread disease. But AIDS activists, facing the lethal upswirl of the epidemic that was decimating their community, could not afford to wait. In the spring of 1987, a group of volunteers splintered away from GMHC to form a group named the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, or ACT UP. Led by a sardonic and hyper-articulate writer named Larry Kramer, ACT UP promised to transform the landscape of AIDS treatment using a kind of militant activism unprecedented in the history of medicine. Kramer blamed many forces for aiding and abetting the epidemic. He called it genocide by neglect. But chief among the neglectors was the FDA. Many of us who live in daily terror of the AIDS epidemic, Kramer wrote in the Times, cannot understand why the Food and Drug Administration has been so intransigent in the face of this monstrous tidal wave of death. Symptomatic of this intransigence was the process by which the FDA evaluated and approved life-saving drugs for AIDS, a process that Kramer characterized as terminally lazy and terminally slow, and terminally gaga. The slow, contemplative, academic mechanism of drug testing, Kramer groused, was becoming life-threatening rather than life-saving. Randomized, placebo-controlled trials were all well and good in the cool ivory towers of medicine, but patients afflicted by a deadly illness needed drugs now. Drugs into bodies, drugs into bodies, ACT UP chanted. A new model for accelerated clinical trials was needed. The FDA is fucked up. The NIH is fucked up. The boys and girls who are running this show have been unable to get whatever system they're operating to work, Kramer told his audience in New York. Double-blind studies, he argued in an editorial, were not created with terminal illnesses in mind. He concluded, AIDS sufferers who have nothing to lose are more than willing to be guinea pigs. Even Kramer knew that that statement was extraordinary. Halstead's ghost had, after all, barely been laid to rest. But as ACT UP members paraded through the streets of New York and Washington, frothing with anger and burning paper effigies of FDA administrators, their argument ricocheted potently through the media and the public imagination. And the argument had a natural spillover to other, equally politicized diseases. If AIDS patients demanded direct access to drugs and treatment, should other patients with terminal illnesses not also make similar demands? Patients with AIDS wanted drugs into bodies. So why should bodies with cancer be left without drugs? In Durham, North Carolina, a city barely touched by the AIDS epidemic in 1987, the sound and fury of these demonstrations may have seemed like a distant thunderclap. Deeply ensconced in his trial of megadose chemotherapy at Duke University, William Peters could not possibly have predicted that this very storm was about to turn south and beat its way to his door. The stamp regimen, megadose chemotherapy for breast cancer, was gathering momentum day by day. By the winter of 1984, 32 women had completed the Phase 1 safety study, a trial designed to document whether stamp could safely be administered. The data looked promising. Although clearly toxic, selected patients could survive the regimen. Phase 1 studies are not designed to assess efficacy. In December that year, at the 5th Annual Breast Cancer Symposium in San Antonio, Texas, there was abundant optimism about efficacy as well. There was so much excitement within the cancer community that some were already convinced, the statistician Donald Berry recalls. Peters was his typically charming self at the conference, boyish, exuberant, cautious, but inveterately positive. He called the meeting a small victory. After San Antonio, the early phase trials gathered speed. Emboldened by the positive response, Peters pushed for evaluating stamp not just for metastatic breast cancer, but as an adjuvant therapy for high-risk patients with locally advanced cancer. patients with more than 10 cancer-afflicted lymph nodes. Following Peters's initial observations, several groups across the nation also hotly pursued megadose chemotherapy with bone marrow transplantation. 2 years later, with early phase trials completed successfully, a randomized, blinded phase 3 trial was needed. Peters approached the Cancer and Leukemia Group B, CALGB, the centralized group that acted as a clearinghouse for clinical trials, to sponsor a definitive, multi-center, randomized clinical trial. On a winter afternoon, Peters flew up from Duke to Boston to detail a stamp trial to the CALGB for its approval. As expected, vicious arguments broke out in the room. Some clinicians still contended that stamp was, in fact, no different from cytotoxic chemotherapy taken to its extreme brink, stale wine being sold in a new bottle. Others contended that the chemotherapeutic battle against cancer needed to be taken to the brink. The meeting stretched hour upon hour, each side hotly debating its points. In the end, the CALGB agreed to sponsor the trial. Peters left the conference room on the sixth floor of the Massachusetts General Hospital, feeling bewildered but relieved. When the hinged saloon door of the room swung closed behind him, it was as if he had just emerged out of a nasty barroom brawl. The Map and the Parachute. Oedipus. What is the rite of purification? How shall it be done? Creon. By banishing a man, or expiation of blood by blood. Sophocles. Oedipus the King. William Peters was trying to convince himself, using a strict randomized trial, that megadose chemotherapy worked. But others were already convinced. Many oncologists had long assumed that the regimen was so obviously effective that no trial could possibly be needed. After all, if the deepest reservoirs of the marrow could be depleted by the searing doses of drugs, how could cancer possibly resist? By the late 1980s, hospitals and increasingly private clinics offering marrow transplantation for breast cancer had sprouted up all around America, Great Britain, and France, with waiting lists that stretched into several hundreds of women. Among the most prominent and successful of the megadose transplanters was Werner Besvoda, an oncologist at the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, South Africa, who was recruiting dozens of women into his trial every month. Transplant was big business, big medicine, big money, big infrastructure, big risks. At large academic centers such as the Beth Israel Hospital in Boston, entire floors were refitted into transplant units, with case volumes that ran into several dozens each week. Minimizing the risks of the procedure using creative phrasing became a cottage industry. As private clinics lined up to perform transplants on women, they christened the procedure a mini-transplant, or transplant light, or even drive-through transplant. Transplanters, as one oncologist put it, became gods at hospitals. This frantic landscape was tipped into further disarray as patients began to file requests for insurance providers to pay for the procedure, priced anywhere between $50,000 to $400,000 per patient. In the summer of 1991, a public school teacher named Naylene Fox in Temecula, California, was diagnosed with advanced breast cancer. Fox was 38 years old, the mother of three children. When she relapsed with metastatic breast cancer after exhausting all conventional therapies, her doctor suggested an autologous bone marrow transplant as a last resort. Fox lunged at the suggestion. But when she applied to HealthNet, her insurance provider, to pay for the transplant, HealthNet refused, stating that the procedure was still investigational and thus not covered by the HMO standard list of clinically proven protocols. In another decade, and with any other disease, Fox's case may have garnered scarcely any public attention. But something fundamental about the relationship between patients and medicine had changed in the aftermath of AIDS. Until the late 1980s, an experimental drug or procedure had been considered precisely that, experimental, and therefore unavailable for general public use. But AIDS activism had transformed that idea. An investigational agent, AIDS activists insisted, was no longer a hothouse flower meant to be cultivated only in the rarefied greenhouses of academic medicine, but rather a public resource merely waiting in the warming antechamber of science while doctors finished clinical trials that would, in the end, prove the efficacy of said drugs or procedures anyway. Patients, in short, had lost patience. They did not want trials. They wanted drugs and cures. ACT UP, parading on the streets of New York and Washington, had made the FDA out to be a woolly bureaucratic grandfather, exacting but maddeningly slow, whose sole purpose was to delay access to critical medicines. HealthNet's denial of Nalene Fox's transplant thus generated a visceral public reaction. Furious and desperate, Fox decided to raise the money privately by writing thousands of letters. By mid-April 1992, an enormous fundraising effort to pay for Fox's transplant had swung into gear. Temecula, a quiet hamlet of golf courses and antique shops, was gripped by a mission. Money poured in from softball matches and pie sales, from lemonade stands and car washes, from a local Sizzler restaurant, from a yogurt shop that donated a portion of its profits. On June 19th, a retinue of Fox's supporters chanting, "Transplant, transplant," and Fox's name, staged a rally outside HealthNet's corporate headquarters. A few days later, Fox's brother, an attorney named Mark Hippler, filed a lawsuit against HealthNet to force the HMO to pay for his sister's transplant. "You marketed this coverage to her when she was well," Hippler wrote. "Please provide it now that she is ill." In the late summer of 1992, when HealthNet refused yet another request for coverage, once again citing lack of clinical evidence, Fox chose to go ahead on her own. By then, she had raised $220,000 from nearly 2,500 friends, neighbors, relatives, co-workers, and strangers, enough to afford the transplant on her own. In August 1992, Nalene Fox thus underwent high-dose chemotherapy and a bone marrow transplant for metastatic breast cancer, hoping for a new lease on her life. In the gleaming new wards of the Norris Center in Los Angeles, where Fox was undergoing her transplant, the story of Werner Besvoda's remarkable success with megadose chemotherapy was already big news. In Besvoda's hands, everything about the regimen seemed to work like a perfectly cast spell. A stocky, intense, solitary man, capable Oz-like of inspiring both charm and suspicion, Besvoda was the self-styled wizard of autologous transplantation, who presided over an ever-growing clinical empire at Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, with patients flying in from Europe, Asia, and Africa. As Besvoda's case series swelled, so too did his reputation. By the mid-1990s, he was regularly jetting up from South Africa to discuss his experience with megadose chemotherapy at meetings and conferences organized all around the world. "The dose-limiting barrier," Besvoda announced audaciously in 1992, "had been overcome," instantly rocketing himself and his clinic into stratospheric fame. Oncologists, scientists, and patients who thronged to his packed seminars found themselves mesmerized by his results. Besvoda lectured slowly and dispassionately in a bone-dry, deadpan drone, looking occasionally at the screen with his characteristic sideways glance, delivering the most exhilarating observations in the world of clinical oncology as if reading the Soviet evening news. At times, the ponderous style seemed almost deliberately mismatched, for even Besvoda knew that his results were astounding. As the lights flickered on for the poster session at the annual oncology meeting held in San Diego in May 1992, clinicians flocked around him, flooding him with questions and congratulations. In Johannesburg, more than 90% of women treated with the megadose regimen had achieved a complete response, a rate that even the powerhouse academic centers in the United States had been unable to achieve. Bezvoda, it seemed, was going to lead oncology out of its decades-long impasse with cancer. Naleen Fox, though, was not so fortunate. She soldiered through the punishing regimen of high-dose chemotherapy and its multiple complications. But less than 1 year after her transplant, breast cancer relapsed explosively all over her body, in her lungs, liver, lymph nodes, and most important, in her brain. On April 22nd, 11 months after Bezvoda's poster was hung up in nearby San Diego, Fox passed away in her home in a shaded cul-de-sac in Temecula. She was only 40 years old. She left behind a husband and three daughters, aged 4, 9, and 11, and a lawsuit against Health Net, now winding its way through the California court system. Juxtaposed against Bezvoda's phenomenal results, Fox's agonizing struggle and untimely death seemed an even more egregious outcome. Convinced that the delayed transplant, not cancer, had hastened his sister's demise, Hippler broadened his claims against Health Net and vigorously pushed for a court trial. The crux of Hippler's case rested on the definition of the word investigational. High-dose chemotherapy could, he argued, hardly be considered an investigational procedure if nearly every major clinical center in the nation was offering it to patients, both on and off trial. In 1993 alone, 1,177 papers in medical journals had been written on the subject. In certain hospitals, entire wards were dedicated to the procedure. The label experimental was slapped on, Hippler contended, by HMOs to save money by denying coverage. If all you have is a cold or the flu, sure, they will take good care of you. But when you get breast cancer, what happens? Outcomes investigative. Outcomes experimental. On the morning of December 28, 1993, Mark Hippler spent nearly 2 hours in the courtroom describing the devastating last year of his sister's life. The balconies and benches overflowed with Fox's friends and supporters and with patients, many of them weeping with anger and empathy. The jury took less than 2 hours to deliberate. That evening, it returned a verdict awarding Fox's family $89 million in damages, the second highest amount in the history of litigation in California, and one of the highest ever awarded in a medical case in America. $89 million was largely symbolic. The case was eventually settled out of court for an undisclosed, smaller amount, but it was also the kind of symbolism that any HMO could readily understand. In 1993, patient advocacy groups urged women to battle similar cases around the country. Understandably, most insurers began to relent. In Massachusetts, Charlotte Turner, a 47-year-old nurse diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer, lobbied ferociously for her transplant, rushing on a wheelchair from one legislator's office to another, with sheaves of medical articles in her arms. In late 1993, as a result of Turner's efforts, the Massachusetts state legislature enacted the so-called Charlotte's Law, mandating coverage for transplantation for eligible patients within the state. By the mid-1990s, 7 states required HMOs to pay for bone marrow transplantation, with similar legislation pending in 7 additional states. Between 1988 and 2002, 86 cases were filed by patients against HMOs that had denied transplants. In 47 instances, the patient won the case. That this turn of events, aggressive chemotherapy and marrow transplantation mandated by law, was truly extraordinary, was not lost on many observers. It was, at face value, a liberating moment for many patients and patient advocates. But medical journals ran rife with scorching critiques of the protocol. It is a complicated, costly, and potentially dangerous technology, one article complained pointedly. The litany of complications was grim. Infections, hemorrhage, blood clots in the arteries and the liver, heart failure, scarring of lungs, skin, kidneys, and tendons. Infertility was often permanent. Patients were confined to the hospital for weeks, and most ominous perhaps, between 5 and 10% of women ran the risk of developing a second cancer or precancerous lesion as a result of the treatment itself. Cancers doggedly recalcitrant to any therapy. But as autologous transplantation of cancer exploded into a major enterprise, the scientific evaluation of the protocol fell further and further behind. Indeed, the trials were caught in an old and perverse quagmire. Everyone, patients, doctors, HMOs, advocacy groups, wanted trials in principle. But no one wanted to be in trials in practice. The more health insurance plans opened their floodgates for bone marrow transplantation, the more women fled from clinical trials, fearing that they might be assigned to the non-treatment arm by what amounted to a coin flip. Between 1991 and 1999, roughly 40,000 women around the world underwent marrow transplantation for breast cancer at an estimated cost of between $2 billion and $4 billion. At the higher estimate, about twice the yearly budget of the NCI. Meanwhile, patient accrual for the clinical trials, including Peters' trial at Duke, nearly trickled to a halt. The disjunction was poignant. Even as clinics overflowed with women being treated with high-dose chemotherapy and wards filled their beds with transplanted patients, the seminal measure to test the efficacy of that regimen was pushed aside, almost as if it were an afterthought. Transplants, transplants everywhere, as Robert Mayer put it, but not a patient to test. When Bezvoda returned to the annual cancer meeting in Atlanta in May 1999, he was clearly triumphant. He rose to the podium confidently, feigning irritation that his name had been mispronounced during the introduction, and flashing his opening slides. As Bezvoda presented the data, his monotonous voice washing over the vast sea of faces in front of him, a spell of silence fell over the audience. The wizard of Wurtz had worked magic again. At Witwatersrand Hospital, young women with high-risk breast cancer treated with bone marrow transplants had showed staggeringly successful results. At 8.5 years, nearly 60% of patients in the megadose transplant arm were still alive, versus only 20% in the control arm. For patients treated with the Bezvoda regimen, the line of survival had plateaued at about 7 years with no further deaths, suggesting that many of the remaining patients were not just alive, but likely cured. Applause broke out among transplanters. But Bezvoda's triumph felt odd, for although the Witwatersrand results were unequivocally spectacular, three other trials presented that afternoon, including Peters's, were either equivocal or negative. At Duke, embarrassingly enough, the trial had not even been finished because of low accrual. And while it was too soon to assess the survival benefits of transplantation, its darker face was readily evident. Of the 300-odd patients randomized to the transplant arm, 31 women had died of complications, of infections, blood clots, failed organs, and leukemia. The news from Philadelphia was even more grim. The megadose chemotherapy regimen had not produced a hint of benefit, not even a modest improvement, as the investigators glumly informed the audience. A complex and tangled trial from Sweden, with patients divided into groups and subgroups, was also headed inexorably toward failure, with no obvious survival benefit in sight. How, then, to reconcile these vastly disparate results? The president of the American Society of Clinical Oncology, ASCO, had asked a panel of discussants to try to hammer all the contradictory data into a single cohesive shape, but even the experts threw up their hands. "My goal here," one discussant began, frankly befuddled, "is to critique the data just presented, to maintain some credibility in the field, and to continue to remain friends with both the presenters and the discussants." But even that would be a tall order. On and off the stage, the presenters and discussants bickered about small points, hurling critiques at each other's trials. Nothing was resolved, and certainly no friendships were made. People who like to transplant will continue to transplant, and people who don't will continue not to. Larry Norton, the powerful breast oncologist and president of the National Alliance of Breast Cancer Organizations, NABCO, told a journalist from the New York Times. The conference had been a disaster. As the exhausted audience trickled out of the massive auditorium in Atlanta, it was already dark outside, and the warm, muggy blast of air provided no relief. Bezvoda left the Atlanta meeting in a hurry, leaving behind a field awash with confusion and tumult. He had underestimated the impact of his data, for it was now the sole fulcrum on which an entire theory of cancer therapy, not to mention a $4 billion industry, rested. Oncologists had come to Atlanta for clarity. They left exasperated and confused. In December 1999, with the benefits of the regimen still uncertain and thousands of women clamoring for treatment, a team of American investigators wrote to Bezvoda at Witwatersrand to ask if they could travel to Johannesburg to examine the data from his trial in person. Bezvoda's transplants were the only ones that had succeeded. Perhaps important lessons could be learned and brought back to America. Bezvoda readily agreed. On the first day of the visit, when the investigators requested the records and logbooks of the 154 patients in his study, Bezvoda sent them only 58 files, all, oddly, from the treatment arm of the trial. When the team pressed for records from the control arm, Bezvoda claimed that they had been lost. Mystified, the team probed further, and the picture began to turn disturbing. The records provided were remarkably shoddy. Scratched out one-page notes with random scribbles written almost as an afterthought, summarizing 6 or 8 months of supposed care. Criteria for eligibility for the trial were virtually always missing in the records. Bezvoda had claimed to have transplanted equal numbers of black and white women, yet nearly all the records belonged to poor, barely literate black women treated at the Hillbrow Hospital in Johannesburg. When the reviewers asked for consent forms for a procedure known to have deadly consequences, no such forms could be found. The hospital's review boards, meant to safeguard such protocols, certainly had no copies. No one, it seemed, had approved the procedure or possessed even the barest knowledge of the trial. Many of the patients counted as alive had long been discharged to terminal care facilities with advanced fungating lesions of breast cancer, presumably to die, with no designated follow-up. One woman counted in the treatment arm had never been treated with any drugs. Another patient record, tracked back to its origin, belonged to a man, not a patient with breast cancer. The whole thing was a fraud, an invention, a sham. In late February 2000, with the trial unraveling and the noose of the investigation tightening around him every day, Werner Bezvoda wrote a terse, typewritten letter to his colleagues at Witwatersrand admitting to having falsified parts of the study. He would later claim that he had altered his records to make the trial more accessible to American researchers. "I have committed a serious breach of scientific honesty and integrity," he wrote. He then resigned from his university position and promptly stopped giving interviews, referring all questions to his attorney. His phone number was unlisted in Johannesburg. In 2008, when I tried to reach him for an interview, Werner Bezvoda was nowhere to be found. The epic fall of Werner Bezvoda was a terminal blow to the ambitions of megadose chemotherapy. In the summer of 1999, a final trial was designed to examine whether STAMP might increase survival among women with breast cancer that had spread to multiple lymph nodes. 4 years later, the answer was clear. There was no discernible benefit. Of the 500 patients assigned to the high-dose group, 9 died of transplantation-related complications. An additional 9 developed highly aggressive, chemotherapy-resistant acute myeloid leukemias as a consequence of their treatments, cancers far worse than the cancers that they had begun with. Although entirely unsuccessful in breast cancers and many solid tumors, ABMT was subsequently shown to cure some lymphomas, again highlighting the heterogeneity of cancers. By the late 1990s, the romance was already over, Robert Mayer said. The final trials were merely trials meant to hammer the nails into the coffin. We had suspected the result for nearly a decade. Maggie Keswick-Jenks witnessed the end of the transplant era in 1995. Jenks, a landscape artist who lived in Scotland, created fantastical and desolate gardens, futuristic swirls of sticks, lakes, stones, and earth shored up against the disordered forces of nature. Diagnosed with breast cancer in 1988, she was treated with a lumpectomy and then a mastectomy. For several months, she considered herself cured. But 5 years later, just short of her 52nd birthday, she relapsed with metastatic breast cancer in her liver, bones, and spine. At the Western General Hospital in Edinburgh, she was treated with high-dose chemotherapy, followed with autologous transplant. Jenks did not know that the STAMP trial would eventually fail. Dr. Bill Peters had already treated several hundred patients with transplantation, she wrote, ever hopeful for a cure. The average length of remission for his patients after treatment was 18 months. It seemed like a lifetime. But Jenks' remission did not last a lifetime. In 1994, just short of her 18th month after transplantation, she relapsed again. She died in July 1995. In an essay titled A View from the Front Line, Jenks described her experience with cancer as like being woken up mid-flight on a jumbo jet and then thrown out with a parachute into a foreign landscape without a map. There you are, the future patient, quietly progressing with other passengers toward a distant destination when, astonishingly, why me? A large hole opens in the floor next to you. People in white coats appear, help you into a parachute, and, no time to think, out you go. You descend. You hit the ground. But where's the enemy? What is the enemy? What is it up to? No road, no compass, no map, no training. Is there something you should know and don't? The white coats are far, far away, strapping others into their parachutes. Occasionally they wave, but even if you ask them, they don't know the answers. They are up there in the jumbo, involved with parachutes, not map-making. The image captured the desolation and desperation of the era. Obsessed with radical and aggressive therapies, oncologists were devising newer and newer parachutes, but with no systematic maps of the quagmire to guide patients and doctors. The war on cancer was lost, in both senses of the word. Summer is a season of sequels, but no one, frankly, was looking forward to John Baylor's. Sequestered away at the University of Chicago, Baylor had been smoldering quietly in his office since his first article, Progress Against Cancer, had sent a deep gash through the NCI's brow in May 1986. But 11 years had passed since the publication of that article, and Baylor, the nation's reminder-in-chief on cancer, was expected to explode with an update any day. In May 1997, exactly 11 years after the publication of his first article, Baylor was back in the pages of the New England Journal of Medicine with another appraisal of the progress on cancer. The punchline of Baylor's article, co-authored with an epidemiologist named Heather Gornick, was evident in its title, Cancer Undefeated. In 1986, he began pointedly, when one of us reported on trends in the incidence of cancer in the United States from 1950 through 1982, it was clear that some 40 years of cancer research, centered primarily on treatment, had failed to reverse a long, slow increase in mortality. Here we update that analysis through 1994. Our evaluation begins with 1970, both to provide some overlap with the previous article and because passage of the National Cancer Act of 1971 marked a critical increase in the magnitude and vigor of the nation's efforts in cancer research. Little had changed in methodology from Baylor's earlier analysis. As before, Baylor and Gornick began by age-adjusting the U.S. population, such that every year between 1970 and 1994 contained exactly the same distribution of ages. The method is described in more detail earlier. Cancer mortality for each age bracket was also adjusted proportionally, in effect, creating a frozen, static population, so that cancer mortality could be compared directly from one year to the next. The pattern that emerged from this analysis was sobering. Between 1970 and 1994, cancer mortality had, if anything, increased slightly, about 6%, from 189 deaths per 100,000 to 201 deaths. Admittedly, the death rate had plateaued somewhat in the last 10 years, but even so, this could hardly be construed as a victory. Cancer, Baylor concluded, was still reigning undefeated. Charted as a graph, the nation's progress on cancer was a flat line. The war on cancer had, thus far, yielded a stalemate. But was the flat line of cancer mortality truly inanimate? Physics teaches us to discriminate a static equilibrium from a dynamic equilibrium. The product of two equal and opposite reactions can seem to sit perfectly still until the opposing forces are uncoupled. What if the flat line of cancer mortality represented a dynamic equilibrium of counterbalanced forces pushing and pulling against each other? As Baylor and Gornick probed their own data further, they began to discern such forces counterpoised against each other with almost exquisite precision. When cancer mortality between 1970 and 1994 was split into two age groups, the counterbalancing of forces was immediately obvious. In men and women above 55, cancer mortality had increased, while in men and women under 55, cancer mortality had decreased by exactly the same proportion. Part of the reason for this will become clear later. A similar dynamic equilibrium was apparent when cancer mortality was reassessed by the type of cancer involved. Mortality had decreased for some forms, plateaued for others, and increased for yet others, offsetting nearly every gain with an equal and opposite loss. Death rates from colon cancer, for instance, had fallen by nearly 30%, and from cervical and uterine cancer by 20%. Both diseases could be detected by screening tests, colonoscopy for colon cancer and pap smears for cervical cancer, and at least part of the decrease in mortality was the likely consequence of earlier detection. Death rates for most forms of children's cancer had also declined since the 1970s, with declines continuing over the decade. So too had mortality from Hodgkin's disease and testicular cancer. Although the net number of such cancers still represented a small fraction of the total cancer mortality, treatment had fundamentally altered the physiognomy of these diseases. The most prominent countervailing ballast against these advances was lung cancer. Lung cancer was still the single biggest killer among cancers, responsible for nearly one-fourth of all cancer deaths. Overall mortality for lung cancer had increased between 1970 and 1994. But the distribution of deaths was markedly skewed. Death rates among men had peaked and dropped off by the mid-1980s. In contrast, lung cancer mortality had dramatically risen in women, particularly in older women, and it was still rising. Between 1970 and 1994, lung cancer deaths among women over the age of 55 had increased by 400%, more than the rise in the rates of breast and colon cancer combined. This exponential upswing in mortality had effaced nearly all gains in survival, not just for lung cancer, but for all other types of cancer. Alterations in the pattern of lung cancer mortality also partially explained the overall age skew of cancer mortality. The incidence of lung cancer was highest in those above 55 and was lower in men and women below 55, a consequence of changes in smoking behavior since the 1950s. The decrease in cancer mortality in younger men and women had been perfectly offset by the increase in cancer mortality in older men and women. Taken in balance, Cancer Undefeated was an article whose title belied its message. The national stalemate on cancer was hardly a stalemate, but rather the product of a frantic game of death in progress. Baylor had set out to prove that the war on cancer had reached terminal stagnancy. Instead, he had chronicled a dynamic, moving battle in mid-pitch against a dynamic, moving target. So even Baylor, especially Baylor, the fiercest and most inventive critic of the war, could not deny the fierce inventiveness of this war. Pressed on public television, he begrudgingly conceded the point. Interviewer: Why do you think they're going down a little bit, or plateauing? Baylor: We think they have gone down perhaps 1%. I would like to wait a little bit longer to see this downturn confirmed, but if it isn't here yet, it's coming. Interviewer: Dr. Baylor? Baylor: I think we might agree that the cup is half full. No single strategy for prevention or cure had been a runaway success. But undeniably, this half-full cup was the product of an astonishingly ingenious array of forces that had been deployed against cancer. The vaunted promises of the 1960s and 1970s and the struggles of the 1980s had given way to a more grounded realism in the 1990s. But this new reality had brought its own promises. Sharply critiquing the defeatism of Baylor and Gornick's assessment, Richard Klausner, the director of the NCI, pointed out, "Cancer is, in truth, a variety of diseases. Viewing it as a single disease that will yield to a single approach is no more logical than viewing neuropsychiatric disease as a single entity that will respond to one strategy. It is unlikely that we will soon see a magic bullet for the treatment of cancer. But it is just as unlikely that there will be a magic bullet of prevention or early detection that will knock out the full spectrum of cancers. We are making progress. Although we also have a long way to go, it is facile to claim that the pace of favorable trends in mortality reflects poor policies or mistaken priorities." An era of oncology was coming to a close. Already, the field had turned away from its fiery adolescence, its entrancement with universal solutions and radical cures, and was grappling with fundamental questions about cancer. What were the underlying principles that governed the root behavior of a particular form of cancer? What was common to all cancers, and what made breast cancer different from lung or prostate cancer? Might those common pathways, or differences for that matter, establish new roadmaps to cure and prevent cancer? The quest to combat cancer thus turned inward, toward basic biology, toward fundamental mechanisms. To answer these questions, we must turn inward too. We must, at last, return to the cancer cell. Part 5. A distorted version of our normal selves. It is vain to speak of cures or think of remedies until such time as we have considered of the causes. Cures must be imperfect, lame, and to no purpose, wherein the causes have not first been searched. Robert Burton, The Anatomy of Melancholy, 1893. You can't do experiments to see what causes cancer. It's not an accessible problem, and it's not the sort of thing scientists can afford to do. I. Herman, Cancer Researcher, 1978. What can be the why of these happenings? Peyton Rouse, 1966, On the Mystery of the Origin of Cancer. A Unitary Cause. It is the spring of 2005, a pivot point in the Medical Oncology Fellowship. Our paths are about to divide. Three of us will continue in the clinic, with a primary focus in clinical research and in the day-to-day care of patients. Four will explore cancer in the laboratory, retaining just a minor presence in the clinic, seeing just a handful of patients every week. The choice between the two paths is instinctual. Some of us inherently perceive ourselves as clinicians, others primarily as scientists. My own inclinations have changed little since the first day of my internship. Clinical medicine moves me viscerally, but I am a lab rat, a nocturnal, peripatetic creature drawn to the basic biology of cancer. I mull over the type of cancer to study in the laboratory, and I find myself gravitating toward leukemia. I may be choosing the laboratory, but my subject of research is governed by a patient. Carla's disease has left its mark on my life. Even so, in the fading twilight of my full-time immersion in the hospital, there are disquieting moments that remind me how deeply clinical medicine can surprise and engage me. It is late one evening in the fellow's room, and the hospital around us has fallen silent, save for the metallic clink of cutlery being brought up for meals. The air outside is heavy with impending rain. The seven of us, close friends by now, are compiling lists of patients to pass on to the next class of fellows, when Lauren begins to read her list aloud, calling out the names of those in her care who have died over our two-year fellowship. Suddenly inspired, she pauses and adds a sentence to each name as a sort of epitaph. It is an impromptu memorial service, and it stirs something in the room. I join in, calling out names of my patients who have died and appending a sentence or two in memory. Kenneth Armour, 62, an internist with stomach cancer. In his final days, all he wished for was a vacation with his wife and time to play with his cats. Oscar Fisher, 38, had small cell lung cancer. Cognitively impaired since birth, he was his mother's favorite child. When he died, she was threading rosaries through his fingers. That night I sit alone with my list, remembering the names and faces late into the evening. How does one memorialize a patient? These men and women have been my friends, my interlocutors, my teachers, a surrogate family. I stand up at my desk, as if at a funeral, my ears hot with emotion, my eyes full of tears. I look around the room at the empty desks and note how swiftly the last 2 years have reshaped all seven of us. Eric, cocksure, ambitious, and smart, is humbler and more introspective. Edwin, preternaturally cheerful and optimistic in his first month, talks openly about resignation and grief. Rick, an organic chemist by training, has become so infatuated with clinical medicine that he doubts that he will return to the laboratory. Lauren, guarded and mature, enlivens her astute assessments with jokes about oncology. Our encounter with cancer has rounded us off. It has smoothed and polished us, like river rocks. A few days later, I meet Carla in the infusion room. She is casually chatting with the nurses, as if catching up with old friends. From a distance, she is barely recognizable. The sheet-white complexion I recall from her first visit to the hospital has warmed up several degrees of red. The bruises in her arm from repeated infusions have vanished. Her children are back in their routine. Her husband has returned to work. Her mother is home in Florida. Carla's life is nearly normal. She tells me that her daughter occasionally wakes up crying from a nightmare. When I ask her if this reflects some remnant trauma from Carla's year-long ordeal with illness, she shakes her head assertively. No, it's just monsters in the dark. It has been a little more than a year since her original diagnosis. She is still taking pills of 6-mercaptopurine and methotrexate, Birchenol's drug and Farber's drug, a combination intended to block the growth of any remnant cancer cells. When she recalls the lowest points of her illness, she shudders in disgust. But something is normalizing and healing inside her. Her own monsters are vanishing, like old bruises. When her blood counts return from the lab, they are stone-cold normal. Her remission continues. I am astonished and exalted by the news, but I bring it to her cautiously, as neutrally as I can. Like all patients, Carla smells overenthusiasm with deep suspicion. A doctor who raves disproportionately about small victories is the same doctor who might be preparing his patient for some ultimate defeat. But this time, there is no reason to be suspicious. I tell her that her counts look perfect and that no more tests are required today. In leukemia, she knows, no news is the best kind of news. Late that evening, having finished my notes, I return to the laboratory. It is a beehive of activity. Postdocs and graduate students hover around the microscopes and centrifuges. Medical words and phrases are occasionally recognizable here, but the dialect of the lab bears little resemblance to the dialect of medicine. It is like traveling to a neighboring country, one that has similar mannerisms but speaks a different language. But the PCR on the leukemia cells should pick up the band. What conditions did you use to run this gel? Agarose, 4%. Was the RNA degraded in the centrifugation step? I retrieve a plate of cells from the incubator. The plate has 384 tiny wells, each barely large enough to hold 2 grains of rice. In each well, I have placed 200 human leukemia cells, then added a unique chemical from a large collection of untested chemicals. In parallel, I have its twin plate, containing 200 normal human blood-forming stem cells, with the same panel of chemicals added to every well. Several times each day, an automated microscopic camera will photograph each well in the two plates, and a computerized program will calculate the number of leukemia cells and normal stem cells. The experiment is seeking a chemical that can kill leukemia cells but spare normal stem cells, a specifically targeted therapy against leukemia. I aspirate a few microliters containing the leukemia cells from one well and look at them under the microscope. The cells look bloated and grotesque, with a dilated nucleus and a thin rim of cytoplasm, the sign of a cell whose very soul has been co-opted to divide and to keep dividing with pathological monomaniacal purpose. These leukemia cells have come into my laboratory from the National Cancer Institute, where they were grown and studied for nearly 3 decades. That these cells are still growing with obscene fecundity is a testament to the terrifying power of this disease. The cells, technically speaking, are immortal. The woman from whose body they were once taken has been dead for 30 years. As early as 1858, Fiorico recognized this power of proliferation. Looking at cancer specimens under the microscope, Virko understood that cancer was cellular hyperplasia, the disturbed pathological growth of cells. But although Virko recognized and described the core abnormality, he could not fathom its cause. He argued that inflammation, the body's reaction to a harmful injury,